Alright, let me get this going. This is Dan Galodner, Wayne State University AFT archivist, talking with Tom Mooney, August 30th, 2006, as part of the AFT Oral History. We were just going to do a wrap-up from our last interview, and we forgot to talk about your presidency as Ohio Federation of Teachers. Why don't you just give us a talk about getting in there and what needed changes you saw that needed to be done?
Well, I guess first of all, I've been, you know, as a local president of a large local, especially, I was active in the OFT for many years. Made a point of even when I was not yet president of the CFT, but an officer, I made a point of trying to organize people to come up to the OFT convention and give CFT a presence in it. CFT had not been sending very many people. Our president before me wasn't that interested, it seemed like. And of course we had no money as a local in those days, in the late 70s, to pay delegate expenses, so I had to kind of organize people to come up, mostly on our own nickel. We couldn't afford to stay at the convention hotel downtown, so we stayed out at the Red Roof Inn south of town and, you know, ferried in, carpooled in every morning. That was okay. It was ferrying home back to the Red Roof Inn late at night after all the hospitalities. It was a little dicey, but we had fun. We were always crammed a bunch of people in a room and stuff. But we really already, right early on began to try to push for some changes in OFT. We perceived clearly that a lot of our problem, and this is before charter schools and vouchers came along, but this was just lack of adequate funding, a very dysfunctional, broken school funding system, which is still broken. They have pumped more money into it, but it's still the same, poor distribution and inefficient use and inequities. So we were clear that we needed a stronger state organization to try to help address those problems. And that the OFT at the time was, what we found was an organization with who didn't have a full-time president, that was mostly treated as a sort of an arm or an extension of the Cleveland local, which was the first large local to kind of get established and get bargaining rights and have a, solid dues-paying membership base. Toledo was was next, and we were still up and coming at the time. And so the presidents had been, pretty long period of time there, were from Cleveland. They were part-time. We had an organizing staff, which slowly morphed into more of a field services staff. We didn't have a full-time lobbyist. We didn't have even a part-time lobbyist. It was a state federation when the structure was created that we were looking at was created like in the late 60s. It was mainly about organizing, and that's good. That was probably what needed to be done then. And to the credit of the Cleveland members and Toledo, they were largely funding this organizing operation. And there was a lot of volatility still in the representation status of a lot of districts around the state, including some of the other large cities like Dayton and Youngstown, where we came close but never, didn't quite make it. And to Columbus, we had a feisty but smaller local. So there was just a lot of potential still before things had kind of settled into your either OEA or OFT, pattern that we now find. But having said that, so we had that strength of having a good organizing staff. We didn't have the representation in Columbus that existing locals, bargaining locals, really needed. So we began to immediately agitate for essentially to raise our dues in order to get more resources and more strength at the state level. That went on for many years. There were pitched battles, particularly with the Cleveland delegation. Toledo was sometimes, dissenting and sometimes along with us and sometimes opposing us in raising the dues, depending on whether they were in a cynical mood or a hopeful mood about the potential of OFT to represent them, more effectively. But we had fun, big, sometimes very ugly battles, but what I really learned some lessons about unionism from being active in the OFT in those early days, which was we would have literally just ferocious, ferocious floor fights.
There you go.
And yet then we would have, there was and still is a tradition, we have this awards banquet at the end of toward the end of the convention, which ends with everybody ringing the banquet hall linking arms and singing Solidarity Forever. Corny, you know. Of course, our young activist, counterculture types thought it was indeed corny, but you know, it gets to you. It works on you, and it actually does mean something that people were sincere in that, you know, feeling of solidarity, even after having disagreed, you know, for the previous 2 days, pretty strongly.
AFT did that in the 40s and the 50s.
Yeah,
same thing.
Well, we still do it. We still do it. Anyway, so we won some victories over the years. It was slow progress, but we did. We were instrumental in getting a full-time president and eventually getting a full-time lobbyist. All this took too long, but you know, it was needed to get done. And we also began to push early on for the OFT office to be moved to Columbus. We had more presence here. That took even longer to get done. But we did succeed along the way in getting a building fund going, which the state began to put some money aside to, so that we could ultimately relocate to Columbus. So we literally were up there pushing to raise our state per capita. Pretty much every conviction we were fighting that battle in order to do certain specific things and try to get those things in the budget. The other interesting, and of course we pushed to get attention to as privatization began to rear its head. We pushed hard to get the union to take that issue up. That wasn't a hard sell, but it took some, somebody had to really be paying attention to it. Eventually, Cleveland became, of course, very concerned about it because they were the target for the first voucher program. The other sort of strand of debate during those years, I'm talking about, the late 70s through the 80s, there were some social issues that our local pushed and had to find allies and other locals, like the divestment issue. The OFT would have been more on the sort of softer Sullivan principles type of approach. Maybe a little bit because of some underlying kind of social conservatism, but mainly because of there was sort of a sacred doctrine around the retirement systems that thou shalt not restrict our ability to invest in the ways that would get the best return, so that we can all have a secure retirement. And they didn't want to hear about any social screen or political screen for those investments, whereas we felt, pretty much our local was united around feeling very strongly that, that there was a line that we didn't want to cross to have more money in our pockets when we retired at the expense of other people's suffering. And our argument was, we don't buy this. Everybody has a line, Mm-hmm. Would you invest in, and we deliberately chose this example to sort of underscore the racial dynamic here. Would you invest in a white slavery racket that was real profitable, running out of, somewhere in Russia to supply, hookers to, the coal mines of Britain or something? I mean, mm-hmm. Yeah, everybody's got a limit, right? So the question is South Africa, which is a virtual slave system, over that line? We think it is. So that was a huge debate. I mean, it was fierce, but we eventually, the big battle, of course, was Cleveland voted as a unit, under unit rule. The delegation would take a position, whatever the majority position was, they were all bound to follow it. We had to break that unit rule. We had to engineer or entice, delegates to rebel. We eventually succeeded. Hmm. Only when they finally split did we pass that. Doesn't mean the retirement system, along with it, but at least we got
there.
OFT. And we had a similar debate about Northern investment in Northern Ireland, which was, I admit, one of my pet causes. And in this case, it was not a divestment policy that was being promoted by national initiatives. It's actually the McBride principles, which were more modeled on the Sullivan principles. It's a different context, different situation, and that was the sort of cutting edge position. There wasn't a further, stronger position for divestment even out there. But we had the same debate. No, we don't want to restrict in any way our investment policies. Only want to focus on maximum return. So there was that, strand of social issues that were debated. So again, once I got to be president of the local, at some point we restructured. One of the two elections in my life that I lost was a foolish bid to run for an OFT vice presidency. So I guess we had three vice presidents And I was, you know, trying to play a stronger role. I wanted to play more of a leadership role in the state organization. This is, again, in the 80s sometime. And I got beat by somebody from Cleveland. And it was a race I just shouldn't have run. I was, you know, I should have been a little more patient. Then we restructured OFT so that it looks a little bit more like the AFT structure, so that there is only one vice president, fewer officers, but there's an executive committee that includes the officers and then appointed members that, at least by political tradition now, intent initially was would include all the large local presidents. And then a good sampling of the more active, you know, presidents from the from smaller locals. Mm-hmm. That's the structure we still have today. So I became part of the OFT executive committee, which really was the leadership, and still is the sort of leadership body. It doesn't have a lot of formal voting power on some very narrow specific issues, but it in fact is the effective leadership body because the votes are around the table are enough to carry anything through a convention if that group agrees. Assuming their delegates follow them, it'll pass. Mm. So I began, you know, get even a more active role, and again, I did begin to think about as at least a possibility that when President Merrick retires, that's something I would want to do. I never was real certain about that until it came up, you know, until it became clear he was getting ready to retire, and. Increasingly, by that point, we're now in the late 90s. It was more and more clear that our problems were emanating from the state level. The state level is increasingly where the action was in terms of education policy, and that we really needed a beefed up state organization badly as a local, and then I believe the other locals did too.
Right.
We, in fact, the way I put it is that we were just as the we're all very clear in the AFT that the. NEA around the country missed the moment when the action shifted to the local level, you know, and they had built these powerful state organizations to lobby and to run insurance programs and legal services when there wasn't any collective bargaining. And when we got collective bargaining in Ohio and other states, they didn't reorganize and shift, you know, the focus and resources to the local level. And that's why we were better. That's why we had a better organizational structure for the needs of local members, especially as it related to collective bargaining. Well, I was now arguing and still arguing that we're in danger of missing the moment when the action is shifting back to the state level. Not that we want to diminish either the autonomy or the resources or the activity level at the local, but that we need to add capacity and action and activity and program at the state level because, you know, everything from instructional policy, academic standards, how we're going to measure progress, what the sanctions are going to be if you don't make progress, but certainly the funding and certainly the push to privatize that we're fighting is all coming from the state capitol. So that is what kind of got me more interested. Frankly, it really wasn't prior to that the career path I had thought I would follow or intended to follow. Sure. Because in the AFT, frankly, traditionally, that you have a stronger role as a leader of a mid-sized, even urban local. You had a more prominent role. You had more possibilities of getting on the map and doing stuff. I mean, what you could bargain in local contracts, including a lot of educational innovation and reform, was more, seemed frankly, more important, you know, and certainly more sort of on the recognized nationally as important. But that was changing. You know, mm-hmm. In the 90s, that was changing. It certainly has only accelerated. That trend has only accelerated, I think. In fact, now it's really the state and the feds wrestling for the controls of the train, you know, mm-hmm. and which track we're going to take, with the locals being relegated more to an implementation role, you know, and figuring out how to finance the unfunded mandates. So anyway, when it became clear Ron was going to retire, I decided to take a shot. And you know, the interesting one of the dynamics here: small local, large local is a major dynamic, as it is in a lot of other states. And Ron, previous president, had come from a small local, and that was really, in a sense, a breakthrough. Because for the first time, the OFT wasn't just an extension of Cleveland, or, you know, long, go back to the 60s, I think we had a strong president from Toledo, Dorothy Matheny. But it was good for the OFT to have a president from a small local. It gave the OFT itself more, I don't know what, importance, independence, you know, played a stronger role, helped allow the organization to play a stronger role, and especially meet the, you know, try to meet the needs of all locals. But I felt like I had something to offer because I had been, you know, not just a large local president, but somebody who had for my whole career been focused on, you know, trying to build up a state organization. So I ran, got elected, and...
what was that, 96?
No, that was only in 2000.
Oh, that's right, 2000.
Yeah. And it was actually kind of the perfect moment for transition. We had finally begun to move on the relocation to Columbus, and I had been pushing it, and others began to push it and support me for the previous couple of years. In the year prior to that election, we formed a search committee to look for a site in Columbus, and I was on that search committee, and we were looking at hoping to buy, but looking at rental possibilities too. So literally right before I was sworn in, right before the convention, we picked this building.
Oh, okay.
And we closed on it, like, literally, you know, within a couple of weeks after I was installed. I was at the closing, signing the paperwork. Then had to spend, it took a year to get it, you know, in shape to move in. And I had to try to figure out how to deal with, you know, architects, plans, permits, etc. And contractors in the city, I don't know. You know, if it was Cincinnati, I could have figured it out. But even commercial, I had done some residential stuff, but commercial is different. Find the right union contractors, especially. But we got it done, and so we ended up, you know, with first one of the really first things I had to focus on was getting that long-awaited headquarters in Columbus. Had a big battle then over shutting down the Cleveland office, phasing it out, what to do with staff that worked out of it, whether to keep it as a satellite. You know, fair amount of internal debate, but it was really just, in a sense, just a debate about the transition, how to treat, you know, some of the staff, particularly the office manager, who we offered a position here, but she, because of family issues, wasn't able to come down. She was great. She was a really, really good employee. And then began to push to expand the presence in terms of staff here in Columbus. The OFT, when Ron was still president in 98, we had done sort of a watershed retreat facilitated by AFT that we called a needs assessment. Mm-hmm. I believe that was shortly after the AFT Task Force on State Federations had done its watershed report. Am I right about the timing of that?
Yep.
So I'm pretty sure we were working from that as a template even then. We still go back to it, refer to it, and use it to help explain why we need to add capacity in the, you know, this area, that area, because, look, this is what state feds are supposed to do. So, but it was new then, and it was still, you know, fiercely debated as to whether we, what the priority should be and whether we really wanted to fund them. But we were on course. At the time I came in, we had agreed particularly to prioritize expanding our educational issues capacity and to add an educational issues director or coordinator. But I had to go ahead and, you know, fill that position. AFT was supporting it on a phase-in, phase-out basis. We had also agreed we wanted to expand legislative and political capacity. We had made the first step of getting, you know, some of the small locals to start a COPE program, but we needed to expand that, and we certainly needed it. We still didn't have, the time I took office, we still did not have a full-time lobbyist. We had a half-time lobbyist who was also a field coordinator with a sort of half a caseload of locals to service. Well, that was totally unacceptable. But I also knew I wasn't going to get, you know, enough dues increase to fund a totally new position. So I took a look at that and I said, okay, can we take that half-time position and make it full-time just by reorganizing, which really meant taking a half a dozen locals that were on her caseload and redistributing them to the remaining, you know, field coordinators. So we went from 4.5 field coordinators down to 4 in order to make that legislative position full-time, but I also redeployed the person involved, you know, and took advantage of a vacancy to reassign that person to strictly field services and posted the position, recruited somebody new for the legislative and political action director. So now we have one, you know, person dealing with all of legislative and political action, which was still inadequate, but it was a big step forward for OFT. Began to also try to create a organizing capacity, because really the OFT had sort of gone to sleep on organizing once the no-rate agreement came in. We had morphed from the period where, again, as I mentioned, representation status of locals was still volatile. Once that really began to settle in, we borrowed a page from the Illinois Federation, again, back in the 80s. And this was something that Ron Merrick led, which was a smart and good thing and well done. We began to try to pursue the crossover strategy. In other words, to get locals of the Association of Lock, Stock, and Barrel switch their affiliation. We got quite a few new locals that way. We probably would have continued to pick up some, you know, at some reasonable handful a year, you know, had that continued, but the no rate agreement came into play. The downside of that strategy was that we lost the capacity, you know, to just organize from scratch. We began to, you know, I guess we had always, in a sense, been thought of ourselves as we were born to raid the association. Although even the 60 wasn't really raiding because, you know, they weren't even a union, they didn't pretend to be, and, you know, but gradually it became more a matter of raiding. So we forgot, in a sense, how to organize the unorganized, you know, from scratch. So we had to recreate that capacity, and that's still a struggle. But initially, it was the first debate we had when I was elected. The very first, it really was a hot debate, other than how to phase out the Cleveland office, was whether to go back to raiding. Because and I've been complimentary of Ron American. I generally will always be, but he sort of threw a hot potato at me on his way out the door. Between my election on Friday and being sworn in Saturday noon, a motion was made on the floor to terminate our no rate agreement with the OEA. And he didn't make the motion because he was chairing, but I'm pretty sure he caused it to be made. And the mentality in the OFT at that point was still very, you know, F them. Yeah. They're big, bureaucratic, clumsy, and probably worse, and they don't support, you know, they don't pursue or represent the needs of urban districts, which is where most of our members are, and et cetera, et cetera. And the only reason we had the no rate agreement in the first place was AFT had it, and we had several locals in transition at the time the national no rate, the first one, was signed. That is, they were trying to get out of the OEA, and the OEA was throwing every possible legal roadblock and costing them money and costing us money to fight those battles. So this is a little bit of digression, but I think it's interesting. When the national no rate agreement came to the executive council, and I'm the vice president, the only vice president from Ohio at that time, because I think Adele had retired. Maybe we were both on. No, I think I was the only one at that time.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I remember the meeting was in Boston. So here it comes before us. I know my folks back home do not want me to vote for this. I know that. That's obvious, you know. And Merrick was still president of the OFT then, because we were still in the process of trying to turn over these locals. But I knew also it was the right thing to do from a national perspective. So what I said is, I will vote for this only if I can get assurances from, you know, the AFT staff and officers that somebody's going to come and help, you know, deal with these locals in transition. And in other words, this is during the war in Bosnia, was still going on, that it's great for folks to sit in Geneva and declare peace in Bosnia, but somebody's got to come to the bridge at Morstar and disengage the combatants, you know,
yeah,
or it won't mean anything. You know, so that was my way out, I suppose, of trying to figure out how to do the right thing and yet represent my constituency back home. So they came through. They did, in fact, help with that process, and it became more Merrick dealing. You know, I wasn't as directly involved then, but they did get the OEA to agree to back off the locals that had voted. They wanted out. They dropped all their legal challenges and whatever, and those were done. But therefore, the agreement is that and one of the trade-offs was we then, as OFT, had entered into a state-level no-rate agreement. We did. But on his way out the door, he arranges for that to be revoked and hands me the hot potato, because then people were thinking, next time my first meeting, the presider of the OT executive committee, they're like, okay, where are we going, Adam? You know, where are we going to go first? You know? Oh, shit. So I had to like work real hard to try to, and what I wanted to do coming in was, in fact, see if we could turn that relationship around, see if we could take a page from the national, you know, and nationals, and take advantage of that fresh agreement and the mergers or merger talks that were going on in other states. And I didn't have any hope of anytime soon getting a state level merger here, but at least nor was I even going to be entertained by the OFT leadership. What I was selling, though, because what I believed in, was we have got to figure out how to cooperate on legislative and political stuff, and we also have to go out and figure out, regain the capacity to organize the unorganized. Because actually, you know, raiding was fun, but it wasn't really adding numbers to the labor movement as a whole. That was a hard sell, because they didn't think of the OEA as part of the labor movement.
Sure.
You know, it was very traditional thinking, AFT type thinking. And so I spent a lot of energy in my first year trying to sell that concept, those two concepts. I brought in Michigan president, who had, on the basis that what he had done is, you know, once a no-rate agreement came in, started to look around and say, well, you know, maybe there are people that aren't organized at all in anything, and maybe we could organize them. They had great, you know, success in the first couple years. And I think they had added 3,000 members in a couple years. Then I brought in Fondi, sort of on a different basis, to talk to him. And I knew some of our urban leaders, particularly knew Fondi and had a lot of respect for him. Also did they for Hugh. They had a lot of respect for him as well, especially the Toledo folks. And Fondi was selling, not organizing, because he hadn't really launched much, but cooperation in the state capitol. It was something he believed in strongly and had claimed a lot of success. And so I was trying to get both those, you know, perspectives. And we made some headway. I mean, these folks have come around a long way. We then were able to convince them, you know, this is incremental, but yet another dues increase to fund at least one full-time, you know, organizing director to take charge and look at the landscape and develop a strategy and figure out how to move us forward. So they've really been supportive. You know, we've done pretty significant, incremental but significant expansion of the capacity of the state federation. But just to back to the OEA strand of the story, so we did go through a series of meetings with them. We achieved a higher level of cooperation. We had a couple of dinners with the executive committees of the OFT and the OEA got together, and things went significantly better for a while in terms of that relationship. Unfortunately, in the last couple of years, it's gone downhill again. Tensions around retirement system elections and retirement system issues before the retirement system, including the fact that as of yesterday afternoon, every member, the OEA had an absolute majority of the retirement board, that is 5 out of 9 for many, many years. Up until last year, nobody could remember anybody from the OFT being not a living memory. Or any unaffiliated, you know, teacher or anything else. They had all the teacher seats. On their watch, the retirement system both hit a financial crisis, which was mostly triggered by the stock market crash a few years ago, but also hit a crisis in its healthcare fund, you know, the healthcare side of the ledger, which was also largely triggered by the stock market crash, but also by lack of foresight and lack of good management and oversight in anticipating this fund was going to run out because of healthcare cost trends, combined with investment, you know, fall in investment earnings. But more to the point, it also blew up in scandal over excessive and extravagant spending on staff benefits that were way out of line with teachers enjoy, on board member travel,
right,
on perks given to board members by companies that did business with the retirement system. And all that has played itself out in significant changes in the composition of the board and in indictments on ethics violations charges of now every board member that was on that board around 2002, 2003, including every OEA member that was on the board, including one incumbent that's still on the board now. Every one of them, as well as a few, the executive director and a couple of other staff. So there's been a lot of tensions around that. Those tensions actually go back to Merrick's time trying to get us a seat on the board. We now have two seats on the board, but we won them the hard way in a contested election after the scandals broke and they lost some of their credibility.
Yeah.
We also have had tensions. It's been up and down around you know, the fight against privatization, where they've been, you know, perceived to be more passive. We've had to take the lead. They want to be at the table. They joined our, you know, the good news was they decided to join our coalition, join our lawsuit after initially filing a separate one. But the bad news is, when, as part of the coalition, they tend to slow things down enormously, want a big voice in the decisions, and want to contribute chump change to either the public relations, you know, side of it, or the, and as well as the legal side of it. So that's been very frustrating, and they will probably complain about me, you know, running with the ball without, you know, consulting everybody every minute. And you know, I think they have no concept how to run a public relations campaign, and couldn't do one if their lives depended on it. And, you know, so there's been tensions around that. So we're at a low ebb of in terms of my presidency, we're at a low point. In fact, we're going to have another round of AFT NEA mediation next month. So that was just kind of that strand. Back to the major track here, which was just, you know, kind of what have we done with the OFT since 2000. So we've added a professional issues director, a full-time legislative and political action director. We then added just 2 years ago a communications director, which was really one of my top priorities coming in the door, because I understand from the way I worked at the local that you can't influence public policy without influence in public opinion. Well, not the other alternatives. You have to have really big checks that you can hand to, in the back room, to politicians, and we haven't got checks that big. So we finally persuaded them to again, just add one person for both public relations, media relations, and internal communication. So she has to do it all, and she does it very well. And then most recently, we took the AFT up on its offer to the SABO position, which is the best, you know, deal they've ever offered us, you know, in terms of helping to support a state-level position on an ongoing basis. So we've expanded the staff pretty, still have the four field coordinators. We're now going through an internal discussion about whether we should reduce that to three, in order, because we have expanded these other areas, or whether the alternative is to really change the role of field coordinators so that they're engaging with locals, not just on when it's negotiations time or when there's a significant grievance or arbitration, but engaging on a continuing basis, getting them activated on legislative and political stuff, getting them involved in more training programs, getting them to participate more in OFT, both governance and, you know, programs and campaigns. And that's, we have an internal task force actually looking at, you know, staffing services and local participation in OFT. And it's going to come to a head prior to this next, our next convention in March. So it's, it has to report before then. So we've, you know, won people over, some of whom were skeptical, on, you know, expanding the capacity of the state fed in a lot of areas. I feel like we've made a ton of progress. I feel really good about where we've been and where we've gotten to. But we still have, you know, some debates that are healthy debates, really. I think this task force, we're going to come out stronger whatever we do, because the discussion has been very deep in just two meetings already about, you know, what are the impediments to getting more locals to participate? How do we, you know, get more engagement? And so I think the field coordinators are going to are quickly coming to realize that it's either A or B. You know, they've either got to look at the job differently or expect to have more, you know, a larger caseload of locals to and still have the expectation that they're going to have to work in a different way, in a more continuous engagement type of way. The other thing we've done is create, of course, with the AFT's impetus, we created the state-level solidarity fund, but not just to receive the rebates from the national level deposit, that we've also now in two increments The last two conventions, we had not only a cost of living increase in dues, and a little bit to help phase in these various staff positions or phase in our share of them. But we've also, in two increments, added set aside some of our state per capita for our own solidarity fund. So the solidarity fund state level is now getting not only the rebates from AFT, but also a direct contribution from state per cap. So that's going to build up and be a very valuable resource in the future. Mm-hmm. We've either participated actively in or helped to actually initiate a number of coalitions here in Columbus around legislative and policy issues that we found is critical to. That's not new, but we just are probably doing more of them than we've ever done to try to influence, expand our influence, but also to ultimately have more influence on public policy and legislation.
Did OFT have an influence in Columbus?
Yeah, even before, I have to say this again, to compliment to my predecessor, is that for our size, and given, he would certainly be down here a lot during legislative sessions, which are pretty much endless. They don't ever really go away unless they want to. There's no limit, legal limit on their length of their or frequency of the sessions. Given a part-time lobbyist and just the president spending part of his time and having to travel from Cleveland to do it, we had influence and visibility beyond our size, but not near enough. Not near as much, I think, as we do now. And the main reason was that we had good leadership. We had very articulate leadership. But the underlying reason was our policies. We simply had better, more sensible policies on educational issues that were more responsive to public opinion, more responsive to contemporary needs in education, and legislators, their policymakers recognize that, mm-hmm. So, but on the other hand, there were, as I found out, the legislators had no clue who we were, felt we only represented Cleveland,
right.
Or a couple cities, maybe they knew we represented Toledo or maybe even Cincinnati, but they had no clue we had locals in other parts of the state because we hadn't activated those locals to communicate with legislators at that point. So, we had a good foundation to build on, but we have expanded that visibility a lot. I don't think if I missed anything major. The thing that I guess I'm most concerned about at this point, other than the ongoing battles for over big public policy issues like privatization and school funding. Internally, I guess the two biggest challenges we still face is, again, how to engage more locals more of the time in the big fights that we're in. And secondly is organizing. It's a real challenge to really create that capacity kind of from scratch. And it's been slower going than I'd like. And I'm trying to do two tracks. One is to look where there is, not necessarily easy pickings, but the possibility for short-term growth, even if it's in small increments. And that's, for example, looking at all the districts where we represent teachers and see what the status of the PSRPs are. And we find out quite a few of them, small, we may be talking about 20 people, 50 people, or whatever, but that are not represented or that are have some kind of little independent group that has some kind of a quasi-contract, but not a real union. So we're working that.
What about higher ed? Is there
higher ed has been the main focus, and again, even that you can divide into the smaller opportunities like community colleges. There's about six community colleges still unorganized, mostly in not close to any of our locals. They tend to be out in the hinterlands, the ones that aren't organized, with some exceptions. But even those, if you were to get all six of them and represent the full-time faculty, you wouldn't end up with very many members.
Okay.
And the part-time faculty, of course, is growing enormously, and they're not covered by the bargaining law. So I would include the full-time community college faculty in the notion of short-term incremental growth where we have a chance to do something solid and short to medium term. But the big target, really, it became clear as we analyzed the potential for growth in our industry, writ large education, that higher ed is the biggest opportunity for growth, and that the big targets are either the four-year universities that aren't organized, or and or the adjunct faculty and graduate assistants. We estimate, nobody's got really good numbers, but there's at least 25,000 adjunct faculty and graduate assistants in just the public, you know, colleges and universities, at least. And right now, nobody else is trying to organize them. So, again, it's been a tug of war to try to get both our people to make that commitment, stay with it, and they've been great. They've given us a lot of latitude to knowing that it's a long-term process. The other tug of war is with AFT to try to get them to devote significant resources to, you know, do these large scale campaigns, knowing that we don't have, you know, coverage under law, knowing that's going to be a long haul and take a lot of political mobilization, a lot of community campaigns and stuff. But, you know, having said that, they've been pretty supportive. We had a strong campaign at the University of Cincinnati, both to affiliate the AUP chapter and also to organize the adjuncts. You know, there were some significant gaps in the staffing of those campaigns, and we came, you know, that close. Maybe some tactical errors too, or strategic errors even. We came like 8 votes short of getting a 2/3 vote of the full time faculty party. You know, it's tragic. Should have got trapped into that 2/3 requirement, and somehow we did. That was really sort of internal sabotage by folks by the technocrats within the AUP chapter didn't want, you know, the old guard didn't want it to happen. Yeah. So the majority's will, and in fact the 63% will, was thwarted. The adjuncts was a viable campaign, and it was allowed to fade as the AFT somewhat lost interest once the full-time faculty weren't going to be part of the deal. But that's one we certainly hope to revive at some point. Meantime, we have a strong campaign, certainly a very challenging one at Ohio State, as many as about 4,500 graduate assistants. Looks like we're going to probably try to carve out the teaching assistants first, which was more like maybe 2,700. Mm-hmm. Certainly still a big challenge. There are also lecturers and postdocs on that campus that we want to look at next. Also another short-term target or medium-term target, adjunct faculty at Owens Community College in Toledo, one of the fastest growing in the state, where we already represent everybody else. Faculty, you call them PSRPs, I don't know if you call them that at the college level, but you know, everybody from clerical to maintenance to custodial, and even the security force, which is in a separate unit. And that's fun because when the faculty was having trouble getting a contract, we went up there for a rally with labor people from the city and stuff, and then we took the rally and marched it right into the administration building, right into the president's office, and the security folks were called, of course, to make us leave. We said, "We're proud to be thrown out by the OFT members who are here to do their job. We respect that," and you know, that was kind of fun. So there's a good example we're talking about. Even with a couple of accretions to get virtually every professional, non-administration professional in the college has now been accreted to the faculty units. We may be talking about 170 people, and there are somewhere between 900 to 1,000 adjuncts. But there's where the AFT feels a little bit more comfortable taking a shot, because they got faculty local as a full-time faculty local as a sort of a base. So my goal is to really do a statewide campaign where we would plant the flag, where we would organize maybe even associate membership program to plant the flag on as many campuses as we can, to mobilize support to change the law, to reach out to sympathetic full-time faculty, students, whoever, and get them engaged in that effort. And so that also when we do, we've got boots on the ground, so to speak, in a lot of campuses when we eventually do get the law changed and are in a better position to fend off the UAW or whoever else, you know, then decides to try to come in. So I'm still hoping to sell that now that there's a little more money in the organizing till. And, you know, AFT has been also kind of waiting to see some change in the political alignment here, and that we hope is about to come to pass. The governor can't decree it, but his support, you know, beginning to some Democratic gains in the legislature could help put us in reach of getting some change there. So, generally speaking, higher ed is our focus. Clean up, so to speak, in the K-12 levels. We had some independent teacher locals that we're continuing to work on affiliating. The other place I had really hoped to go when I first was elected and began to think about an organizing strategy was early childhood. And to be honest, AFT has slept, you know, while AFSCME and SEIU have gobbled it up. Mm-hmm. And I've been, you know, yelling about that ever since the organizing committee was created, however many years ago that was now. It must be 3 or 4 years. And they finally are seeming to focus on it, but honest to God, they've really allowed competitors to grab very strategic, you know, hilltops, like, in other words, the larger Head Start units. And I know this in great detail in Ohio because my wife was the one doing it. For SEIU, that woke up AFSCME. They've got now quite a few. We're not writing it off, but at least we do now. Because when I was first elected, you didn't have the tools, the resources that you need to come in and say, we can represent you well. That was readily available in the hire. The hire department's got great stuff. We got the policy stuff. We got the organizing stuff. We got, you know, conferences to send people to. We didn't have any of that in early childhood. Now the infrastructure is kind of there, at least to some, I think, to an adequate degree. But again, others have gotten a big head start.
Is this the one reason they brought in the child care workforce?
Yeah, group? That's one of the reasons. That was the first sort of, yeah.
Indications that AFT was going to do it.
Yeah, but it's been very slow. I don't really understand. Never have understood why. Uh-huh. So that's with a little bit of wandering, I guess that's kind of what we've been doing.
Okay.
At OFT. What I was just working on when you got here is starting to think about the next stage of leadership transition, as well as just increasing our effectiveness of our state-level representation. You know, now we're creating, as part of an extension of our ULI, so we also created an OFT ULI that didn't exist before, to complement, you know, the AFT ULI stuff and get people who aren't going to make their way to Wisconsin for the Great Lakes or to Washington for various conferences. And it's gotten off to a really good start. We've had now 3 summer institutes, as well as we'll do 2 or 3, you know, Saturday programs during the year. We also have a local leaders conference at the end of September. We've expanded that to some training as well as, you know, current issues. And as part of that, as an extension of that, we're creating a state leaders seminar. It's by invitation, which we're looking for people who have shown, you know, leadership potential and are interested in playing more of a leadership role at the state level, or maybe are already representing OFT on some state level committee. So we're looking to strengthen our ability to put people on, you know, nominate people for various state level committees of the right academic standards and review test items to curriculum frameworks that the state develops for local use, commissions, task forces that the governor appoints or that, you know, legislature creates, chairing OFT standing committees, chairing convention committees, or, you know, future OFT officers, the whole gamut, basically. But one of the premises is you send people to one of these committees. They may be very able, they may be very smart, they may know their field very well, but if they don't know what the hell's going on, they don't say much, you know? I mean, it takes an extraordinarily assertive individual to walk in there and start, you know, being assertive. You know, you kind of want to know, well, it helps at least a lot to know, well, who else is represented on this task force? Okay. Who are these other people, where they come from? What are their organizations take on this issue? What's really the subtext? What's really going on, you know, in this debate? Beyond the formal, you know, what's on paper. So that, you know, context is really crucial for any kind of representation role. So I'm real excited about that. We're going to send the invitations out within the next day or two. And again, hoping to plant some seeds for future leaders before, you know, while I'm still around.
That's excellent. That's something that most states really need.
And honestly, it was inspired by some really good leadership development work that some of our locals do, even some of our smaller locals, like our Oregon locals, incredible program. Cleveland Heights, although it isn't as formal as a course, they do very well. They seem to do very well at recruiting and bringing new leaders up through the chain. Cincinnati president, although again, it's not as maybe a formal process, has done very well at identifying in the last couple of years younger folks, and also pays a lot of attention to diversity in recruiting leadership and staff. So it was clearly time for OFT to take a page from all those efforts.
Excellent.
What I miss, OFT, a great office staff too. I have to brag a little bit.
Okay.
I never had the chance to actually just hire. Like, you know, in a local, even though we had staff, there's a lot of politics to it. There's a lot of, you know, who's in line, who's worked their way out, blah, blah, blah. So this is the first time I got a chance to hire staff by, you know, actually advertising, screening, interviewing. And, of course, we have internal applicants, but also external. I've actually turned out to be halfway good at it. People seem to be real pleased, and I'm very pleased with who we've hired. So, you know, because you can make a mistake, and you only have one person in legislation and one person in communication and one person in organizing. It's like, what? That could kind of blow your whole program, you know, if you hire the wrong person. So.
That's excellent. Yeah. Do you want to move into TURN? Talk about it.
Sure, yeah.
Why don't we just start from the beginning? How did TURN formalize?
Well, that involves a little AFT politics, but there's no way to tell it, make a truthful account of it without. You probably have heard some of this without going into that. It was really since born out of the ashes of an AFT initiative, which I think was called Leadership for School Reform. You know, it goes back to the time period when Al was really emerging as a champion of school reform, you know, late 80s into the 90s. And it's when Jeannie Kimball was running the Ed Issues Department. Adam Urbanski was chairing the closest thing we had to an Ed Reform, you know, component of our governance structures. It was actually called the Education Research Committee of the Executive Council, but it became the vehicle for discussing, you know, education policy, not just research. And so he was, you know, basically the AFT headquarters created this thing, invited folks from various locals that seemed interested in education reform, a lot of whom came out of the ER&D network that was at that time, you know, sort of emerging, as well as some locals that, if they didn't have ER&D, they were doing other interesting reform initiatives. And Adam was there sort of presiding and being, you know, involved as in his role as the chair of the relevant committee. I don't know, had a series of meetings. It gets a little dim in terms of what we actually did. We had speakers, we had, you know, programs.
Is that your wife?
Yes, yeah, somebody I may or may not have lunch with. Hold on one second.
Okay.
All right, this is actually a very, pretty interesting story. It'd be interesting to get other people's take on it.
Well, you're the first one to talk about TURN.
Really? Adam would certainly have a lot to say about this. But so other people were closely involved. Louise Sundin, for example. So anyhow, long story short, there was healthy, vigorous discussion and debate during these sessions. But there was a tension between the fact that typically the people that were involved in the professional side of union activity, which was kind of a newly emerging strand at that time, people who were involved in the R&D tended to be, I'm using the term in a very sort of historical context, tended to be, I would say, sort of, you know, just political and cultural liberals in a fairly mainstream sense, coming out of the baby boom era, influenced by various radical and protest movements of the 60s and 70s. Those, I think, union activists in general, you know, that tends to be the case. And so they had a certain take or certain bias on cultural issues that were sort of hot button issues at the time, and where AFT's take tended to be in a very particular niche, the folks out in the hinterlands didn't necessarily even know or recognize. I'm talking about, the certain amount of cultural traditionalism or cultural conservatism, you might even say, that was a part of, you know, Shanker's vision of education and education reform. So what were the hot button issues at that time? And this is pretty much all dissipated by now, but bilingual education, mm-hmm. multicultural education, which is a very, you know, loose term, but a hot button issue for some at the time. So the Educational Issues Department was, you know, going to try to stick pretty closely to the AFT line. And so they, the incident that really kind of sticks in my mind is when Jeannie brought in E.D. Hirsch to speak to the group. And I would be, have been one of the people in the audience that was kind of bristling at listening to E.D. Hirsch, because I had him in the same camp in my mind with Bill Bennett and his Book of Virtue that came later. But Hirsch's, you know, core curriculum was seen as, and was criticized a lot by, as being, you know, very sort of Eurocentric and traditional Western civ kind of approach. I have a lot of respect for him, by the way, and I think my perception, it's not that I've followed this, you know, in great detail, but my general perception about him is that he was pretty stung by those criticisms, including the ones he got, the flat he got from our group, and that he has adapted his stuff pretty quickly to, you know, take some of those concerns into account. Bill Bennett, of course, you know, was selling. He was being a politician. Hirsch was actually trying to, you know, being an educator and trying to create something useful educationally. So Bennett hasn't budged. So we find out, you know, his traditional values ain't so high. Falutin.
Yeah.
There were other incidents like this, or other instances of that in deliberations.
Yeah, American Educator was caring a lot from Ravitch.
Oh yeah,
about that stuff. Yeah. And Hirsch and basically that whole,
yeah,
what was it called? Teacher core network, teacher network. This pushing all this stuff, right? Go on, I'm sorry. Yeah,
and even on, you know, AFT1 and all that lightened on, you know, gay rights and, you know, some other, there were some cultural tensions that were an outgrowth of a certain political philosophy, and there was a clash between that very sort of specific ideology. That again, most AFT actors out in the field wouldn't even been able to necessarily describe or identify or know what it was, but all they knew was that on some of these issues that came up in the course of our deliberations and some of the speakers we had, they didn't like it, they didn't agree. So there was this tension, and they kind of pushed back. They weren't just behaving like sheep and going along with the party line. Somebody got uncomfortable with that. It may have been Jeannie, and in terms of then what she recommended, it may have been reports that it may have been Al, based on reports he was getting back, and that I'm only, you know, guessing from the outside, but because I was a participant, but not really in sort of the AFT hierarchy at that time. So we got dissolved. This institute got, you ought to get Adam's side of the story at some point, because he would know more firsthand. But at some point, he was, you know, called in and told it was over. So. And didn't get what he felt. You know, I know this from talking to him. He felt it was a good explanation. Nor did the rest of us. So, gee, AFT is the mother of autonomous locals. You know, is like has encouraged, you know, independent, autonomous, self-activated, you know, locals and local creativity and initiative, etc. So, and especially those locals who were taking Al's missives to heart about, you know, trying to play a leadership role in school reform, increasingly found that we needed to network, you know, because a lot of the action, more so even than now, was local. What, you know, initiating around professional development, peer review, career ladders, restructuring schools, trying new approaches to reaching disadvantaged kids or dropouts or discipline, or, you know, schools hard cases and discipline, all sorts of things that we were trying to do. We just needed a network. And so literally TURN was created in a sense out of the ashes of this AFT-led initiative, and just created an autonomous sort of self-governed but loose sort of network. And I was involved in those early discussions. Diana Porter from my local was very involved in them, but it ended up being Adam and Ellen Bernstein from LA, UTLA, that actually convened the first meeting. And it was, you know, deliberately, by design, it crossed, you know, organizational lines. At that time, it was hard to find NEA locals, but, you know, we wanted to recognize those few NEA locals who were trying to do some educational reform and create something, you know, for over time that might encourage, you know, more NEA affiliates to take up that approach.
What was their first initial reaction? Approaching NEA,
You know, as you probably know, there were then some tensions, I wouldn't say rising level of conflict, but tensions, let's just say, about what is within AFT, about, you know, what is this thing and how independent is it? Is Adam Hugh going to use it for a political vehicle, you know, et cetera? NEA has so many networks, so many, you know, caucuses, so many substructures that I don't think they ever blinked. You know, it just didn't create the same, a very different political structure, you know. I don't think it just didn't create any big concern. You know, they at least were nominally supportive of it. And mainly the staff that there, you know, there were always staff within NEA who were more educationally progressive than the policies of the organization would reflect. And so they encouraged, you know, certainly within the staff there were people who encouraged it. And it, you know, something AFT.